You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hello. Welcome to the Latin American History Podcast. Episode 126, The Manila Galleons, Part 2. Last episode, we outlined the main features of the Manila Galleon trade, how it was established, who was involved, and the cultural impact it had on those places and the wider world. Today, we're going to hone in on some of the most interesting aspects, the migration which accompanied it, how it linked to existing trade networks and geopolitics, particularly with Portugal, and the pirates who were lured in by the wealth being shipped across the Pacific. There were people, like the missionaries and the administrators we saw last time, who travelled on the Manila galleons as well as goods, and this was not a phenomenon which only went one way. We will come back to Mexican migration in a minute. But plenty of Filipinos and people from other parts of Asia stayed on the Mexican side of the ocean. Catarina de San Juan, who inspired that style of dress in Puebla, is one example we've already seen. I mentioned that she was probably brought to Mexico, having been enslaved. This was not uncommon. Slavery was practiced in maritime Asia, and some of those people who were captured ended up in Mexico. I also briefly mentioned last episode that Filipino sailors were often pressed into service, and that even for those who joined up willingly, conditions on the ships were tough, sometimes fatal. In 1619, the captain of one ship lamented that only 5 of the 75 Filipino crew who had left Manila were still there to man the trip back. The rest had deserted, settled in Mexico, and some had married local women. It's estimated that somewhere between 40,000 and 100,000 people from Asia arrived in Mexico over the centuries the Manila galleons were running. Not all were there against their will, and some seem to have done quite well. One example of a Filipino who owned land was Andres Rosales, who owned 28 coconut palms in 1619. Many Filipinos found work on coconut plantations on the Pacific coast. Becoming a barber seems to have been another particularly popular occupation, and there were complaints made by local hairdressers about the newfound competition. Most seem to have stayed on the coast around Acapulco. A 2018 study found that 1/3 of the population of Guerrero, the state which Acapulco was in, may have up to 10% Filipino ancestry in their DNA. That's not an insignificant amount. There is one more instance of migration from Asia, which, while not hugely significant in size, is pretty interesting. In 1614, a Japanese samurai leader and a Spanish missionary set off for Mexico, with around 140 more samurai, merchants, and assistants. The noble who had sent them did so in an attempt to get permission to trade directly with Mexico, separate from the Manila galleons. This never came to pass, but most of the Japanese stayed in Mexico, some apparently occupying prominent positions in colonial society in Oaxaca. We already know that much of the colonial administration of the Philippines was carried out by people from Mexico, and so obviously lots of people came over to Asia in this capacity. There was another large group who made that trip across the Pacific. The Philippines needed soldiers to maintain order and to protect it from invasion. The Mexican authorities decided to kill 2 birds with 1 stone and make military service in the Philippines a criminal punishment. This specific practice developed over the course of the centuries which the galleons operated. However, something similar happened from the very beginning. You might remember from the Conquest of Mexico series that Cortes secured an alliance with the Tlaxcala civilization, who fought alongside him and helped him defeat the Aztec. Well, when the Spanish conquered the Philippines, this alliance was still in place. And so fascinatingly, Tlaxcalan soldiers, along with people drawn from other indigenous groups, actually participated in the conquest of this distant land across the ocean. The transportation of criminals to the Philippines really ramped up around 1765 and continued until Mexican independence. People usually found themselves on the ships to Asia for lower-level crimes or for vagrancy. Vagrancy was a term of which the exact definition changed over time, but which generally referred to people who were perhaps homeless or willing to move around in search of work. Poverty was often a key feature, and sometimes people who found themselves labelled vagrants were simply people who had fallen on hard times, particularly when crop failures in the second half of the 1700s drove many off the land in Mexico to try to find work in cities. The term vagrant was associated with begging, drinking, and suspicions of crimes like theft. Sometimes this may have been correct, although of those who did fit the bill, some would probably have turned to these things because of their situation. A surprisingly significant number of people were turned into the authorities by their own family members. Presumably many of these hoped that it would teach them a lesson and put them onto a different path, with them returning as new and better people. It rarely worked out like that. Eva Maria Mill, who wrote the book on the subject, says that between 1765 and 1811, Manila Bay received 3,995 Mexican and Spanish troops and convicts. The majority were veterans and recruits, 3,219, or 80.5%. At least 336, 8.4%, were victims of vagrancy campaigns or were convicted criminals, of whom 62, 1.5% of the total, had been turned in by their own relatives. Additionally, 254 of the total, 6.3%, were deserters who had been sentenced to the Philippines, and 190, 4.8%, were convicts shipped to the Philippines from Spain. She says that there are very few documents which provided evidence of people returning to Mexico, so the logical conclusion is that most ended up staying in the Philippines. She mentions a woman whose husband was sent there, but who died in a shipwreck on the way. She did not find out until 8 years later. Given all this, I wonder how many of those people who reported family members ended up regretting their decision. The under-resourced governors of the Philippines needed soldiers to protect their remote colony. But many of those sent from Mexico actually caused more harm than good. Mel says that in 1780, 177 Mexican recruits arrived in the Philippines aboard the Naos de la China, or Manila Galleons. These men were the annual replacements for the Regiment of the King, Manila's premier military unit, composed largely of veteran soldiers. The new cohort of 1780 turned out to be a very disruptive squad, who caused tremendous headaches over the following 4 years. As the governor of the Philippines, José Basco y Vargas, discovered later, most of these recruits had been drawn from the regimental prisons, and quite a few were charged with capital crimes. The governor laments, saying it was unimaginable how much work they had given them with their actions and bad example. Estimating the legacy of this migration today is difficult. Most Filipinos have Spanish surnames, so you can't use this as an indicator of ancestry. In the 1800s, a German ethnographer looked at censuses and came to the conclusion that Luzon, the biggest island in the Philippines where Manila and half of the total population is, was home to a people, a third of which had some degree of Spanish, mostly presumably Mexican ancestry. I don't know how accurate his methods were, but it's an interesting figure. And even if he did overstate things, I would guess that the accurate number must not be inconsequential. A 2021 study concluded that 2% of the population had Spanish ancestry. I don't know if any evidence has come up looking at the amount of indigenous North American ancestry. From what we've covered so far, we know that the Manila galleon trade was a truly international affair, linking Spaniards, indigenous and mestizo Mexicans, Filipinos and China. It was, however, even more international than that, and this was because of another important aspect of the Manila galleons, the involvement of Portugal. Spain may have run the galleons and supplied the silver, but Portuguese merchants were heavily involved in actually sourcing the goods, which went the other way. At some point I will do some episodes on Portugal's non-American empire, and if I can find enough material, how it may have linked to Brazil, or at least influenced decisions made about, and the course of development there. When Spain decided to pivot its focus towards China and the Pacific, away from the Spice Islands, Portugal's initial satisfaction at having seen the Spanish off quickly turned to concern, as they realised that they no longer had a monopoly on bringing all the other goods to Europe. Then they realised that they were well placed to insert themselves into the trade, and those concerns faded. There were a number of reasons why Portuguese merchants were able to do this. Firstly, they had a head start on the Spanish, and had already built up networks of local contacts and relationships across Asia, as well as local knowledge about how business was done. If you have watched the series Shogun, you will know that they had obtained exclusive permission to trade in Japan, for example. Then there was the fact that their colonies produced goods which were desired in Latin America and Europe, which the Philippines didn't. They controlled Malacca, in today's Malaysia, Goa and other parts of India, Sri Lanka and parts of Mozambique on the East African coast, as well as, of course, the Spice Islands themselves. Perhaps their most important settlement, however, was Macau, right next to today's Hong Kong on the Chinese mainland. It was from here that Portugal was already shipping silk and porcelain to Europe. Chinese merchants did launch the majority of ships which sailed to Manila. However, many items found their way to Macau, where the Portuguese sailed them across to the waiting galleons. This relationship was not always easy. The two European trading settlements, so close to each other, could easily have become rivals. Portugal at first tried to keep the Spanish out of China completely and retain their monopoly there. They also feared that the Spanish might expand into their markets in places like Japan and Thailand. Another factor soon emerged, which helped see off the threat of competition and cement the links between Manila and Macau. Thank you to the sponsor of today's podcast, Warpath. The men of Second Company had their mission, but war is never predictable, and even the best laid plans crumble under the chaos of battle. If you're the kind of person who thrives in that environment and loves tactical decision-making, then you need to check out Warpath, a strategy game that lets you immerse yourself in battles with realistic terrain, sound, and gorgeous visuals. With over 30 million downloads and a 4.6 star rating on iOS, Warpath lets you build the ultimate armory, customizing over 300 units with 1,000 unique modifications, and allowing you to forge real-life weapon parts to upgrade your arsenal. But brute force alone won't win the war. Like the Colonel, you need strategy. Thanks to Warpath's responsive RTS controls, you can use tactical positioning, air support and flanking manoeuvres to outwit your enemy in massive battles. You can employ creative solutions to take out your enemy, by using sniper rifles, for instance. And the best part? You're never out of the fight. Rapid recruitment lets you reinforce your troops when they're in the field, and even if you're defeated, you keep all of your resources. Experience an ever-shifting battlefield with army groups, artillery, flanking, air support, and more in this fun-filled war simulator game. So if you're ready to test your courage, tactics, and mettle against brilliant commanders from around the world, download Warpath today on PC or mobile by using the link in the description.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
You might remember in a previous episode entitled An Old World Update that due to inheritance laws and a lack of an heir in Portugal, the two countries, Spain and Portugal, found themselves unified under one king at the end of the 1500s. This news actually reached Macau from Manila. The governor decided to send a Jesuit priest with the news, knowing that the Jesuits were also powerful in Macau. Despite their religious brotherhood, the Jesuits there did not receive him happily. Neither did the local Chinese authorities, who were happy and profiting from dealing with the Portuguese, and wondered if this new situation would disrupt that. So there was still tension, even if in the long run this new arrangement probably helped to ensure that everyone made lots of money. Portugal had received guarantees of its independence, and that its interests would not be subsumed by Spanish ones. This was a concern everywhere, and Asia was no different. In 1589, the nation of Portugal sent a letter to the Council of the Indies, the Spanish body in charge of the administration of Latin America, warning that the galleon trade was damaging Portuguese colonies in Asia, and thus subjugating their interests to Spanish ones. They also speculated that Spain's American colonies might even grow so reliant on Pacific trade that they might become disconnected to the European motherland. In the end, however, things seemed to have turned out okay. Portugal's Asian colonies did not collapse, and its merchants established themselves and profited. When Latin America eventually became independent, it had nothing to do with anything across the Pacific. I have read conflicting things about Spain's official attitude to these merchants, once the crowns were unified. One source says that an agreement was made that allowed the Portuguese into Manila, but prohibited them from trading directly with Mexico. Another, however, says that the trade between Macau and Manila was technically illegal, even though it was flourishing in practice. Whatever the legality, soon Portuguese merchants were expanding into the cross-Pacific route itself. This was as merchant sailors travelling on the galleons, not as independent actors. In 1590, one ship did set off from Macau and reach Acapulco, but everything on board was confiscated, as only the Manila galleons were allowed to cross the Pacific. On the Mexican side of things, anyone with the right to be in the colony could involve themselves with buying and selling goods from the galleons, no matter what their nationality. The prohibitions related only to the Pacific crossing, so the people who bought the goods there and distributed them were not just Mexican or Spanish. They were Portuguese merchants, as well as people from Italy and other parts of Europe. I find it satisfying when things we've covered in previous episodes come up again, and help to link things together and provide a bigger picture. The impact of the union of Spain and Portugal, which we had previously looked at, seen this time from Asia, is a good example. Another relates to one of our recent Friends of the Podcast episodes, where we looked at the Portuguese-Jewish converso presence in northern Mexico. Well, that time period forms part of the one we're discussing now, and so again, we see Jewish conversos avoiding religious persecution and involving themselves here. some bought goods in Acapulco for resale, while others settled in Peru and involved themselves with sending the silver up to the galleons. One man, Bartolomé Vaz Landero, obtained permission to trade between Japan and Macau before moving on to the Macau-Manila route. Beyond these, there are records of his commercial presence in Thailand, Cambodia, Timor, and India. We touched on this last episode when we talked about the peacock feathers and ivory recorded as entering China. But the goods Portuguese merchants supplied to the galleon trade from other parts of Asia included wheat, rose water, almonds, fans, cotton textiles, white cord, sweets, rice, spices, quilts made in Bengal, amber, jewels, precious stones, and slaves. There are two last aspects of the Manila galleons I want to briefly mention. The first is its role in the development of California. We've seen in previous episodes that Spain claimed large parts of what is now the western USA, but that the further north you went, the less integrated and settled the land was. California, both Alta, today's US state of California, and Baja, the Mexican peninsula, were like the settlements we saw in New Mexico, frontier outposts populated in large parts by missionaries. One day we will cover the subject on the podcast. California, however, did have opportunities for development thanks to its coastal position. When those galleons made their way back towards Mexico, the currents obliged them to take an indirect route to the north, and so they passed southwards along the Californian coast. Often they would stop there to resupply, and the town of Monterrey in particular prospered during the latter part of the Manila galleon era. Much earlier, in October 1587, one of the ships landed at Morro Bay on its way to Acapulco, and its crew went ashore. There was a confrontation with the indigenous Chumash people, and one Spaniard and one Filipino sailor was killed before they went back to their ship and continued their journey. This event has become known as the landing of the first Filipinos. It did not lead to Filipino settlement in what is now the USA, neither did later stops in California involving sailors. However, it has symbolic significance, as it is the first time that people from Asia are known to have stepped on to what would become US soil. For context, this was 33 years before British settlers arrived at Plymouth Rock. Finally, just as the treasure fleets sailing across the Atlantic helped drive the rise of Caribbean piracy, so too the Manila galleons were an attractive target, being laden with silver and expensive goods from Asia. Of course, it was sometimes hard to differentiate pirates from privateers working for foreign governments during time of war. The first attacks on galleons were made by Francis Drake and Thomas Cavendish, both operating in connection with the English Crown. Drake didn't actually know about the galleons. The route was only 6 years old, and Spain had so far managed to keep it a secret. He raided multiple ships on his way up the coast from Peru, and these contained Chinese silks, silver on its way to Acapulco, and an important Spanish official making his way there to transfer to the Philippines. He also discovered maps which outlined the route, and so the existence of the Manila galleons became public knowledge. He considered attacking Acapulco itself when he reached it, but decided against this and continued north. Soon afterwards, Cavendish captured one of the actual galleons near the end of the Baja California Peninsula. This one contained gold and silk, which Cavendish took back to England. Last month's Friend of the Podcast episode was based on a first-hand account of a pirate community in Mexico, written by William Dampier. Now we meet him again, later in his career. Dampier had moved to the Pacific by this point, and set out searching for Manila galleons to raid. He had little luck on the American coastline, and spotted one near Guam, but it managed to escape his pursuit. Next he drifted around Southeast Asia, struggling to keep his crew happy due to the lack of plunder, and suffering from typhoons, before giving up and sailing home. Later, however, war with Spain had broken out, and he decided to have another go, this time with legal backing. This venture was also a failure. He encountered one of the galleons off the coast of Mexico, but his attack went badly, and he was lucky not to be sunk himself. One last incident involving British pirates is worth mentioning, because it involves another character we already know, and because it's quite funny. Clipperton, the man who the island we looked at in the Clipperton Island episode, had a plan to raid a Manila galleon alongside a man named Shelbock. Each had their own ship, and they did not get on. They searched the Pacific together for a while before splitting up. Shelbock would suffer during this time. Soon, he only had 40 of his crew left from the original 160. He had, however, managed to capture a small Spanish ship. So when Clipperton sighted him, he launched a hostile boarding, only to realise halfway through that he was attacking his own colleague. The two decided to have another go at finding a Manila galleon. But before they found one, they got into an argument about how any plunder should be divided, and so they separated again and gave up. In total, the English managed to seize 4 galleons over the centuries which they operated. It was the Dutch who were the most voracious in their attacks. They focused on the Asian side of the Pacific, as it was in Indonesia where they had established their most important colonies. That didn't mean that they exclusively focused their efforts there. In 1624, a fleet occupied Acapulco harbour and decided to wait for the galleons to arrive, only giving up when they ran out of water. For the most part, though, they attacked the galleons in the straits between the Filipino islands. As far as I can tell, they sank a few and disrupted the trade by preventing the ships from sailing, but they don't appear to have captured many. For the Dutch, this was part of a wider attempt at conquest and empire building. Unlike those English pirates and privateers who wanted to raid ships for profit, the Dutch actually wanted to capture land in Asia. The attacks on the galleons were just part of this campaign. The worst disruption they caused to the trade was a result of their persistent, unsuccessful attempts to take Manila itself. If you've enjoyed this episode and you want to do something to help the show, one thing that's really helpful is if you could leave a review wherever you get your podcast from. A huge thank you to everyone who's already done this. And thank you to everyone for listening. You've been listening to the Latin American History Podcast, written and recorded by me, Max Argent, edited by Alex McNamara. If you've enjoyed the podcast and want to get access to extra episodes, you can become a friend of the podcast. There's information about how to do this in the episode description. The podcast is also available on YouTube by searching for the Latin American History Podcast. If you'd like to send me a message, or if you have any questions, you can email me at historyoflatinamericapodcast@gmail.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.